There is a rhythm in the presidency of the United States. It's in the nature of things that a presidency begins at a moment of high triumph with the inauguration of a victor. It seems equally in the nature of things that a low point occurs near the middle of the victor's term. By then, some bright hopes have paled. Goals, once clear, have become obscured. Energies are depleted, tempers frayed, patience short, and quarrels common. It is any president's good fortune that those who wrote the Constitution provided him an opportunity to surmount such difficulties. They did so, knowingly or unknowingly, by stipulating in Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, that a president shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the state of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. Well, in meeting these obligations to say where we are and what we should do, a president can inspire new hope, redefine goals, and infuse new energy into his administration. Shortly, we shall hear our 36th president, Lyndon B. Johnson, report to our 90th Congress that convened today on the State of the Union. Well, clearly, Mr. Johnson will be reporting to a far larger body than the 535 senators and representatives gathered in the House chamber in Washington. He'll be reporting to the entire nation and indeed the world. The hour chosen by the president, mid-evening for most of us, the prime medium of communication, television, and delivering his address in person rather than having it read by a House clerk, all testify to the importance he attaches to the occasion. Now, the Congress that will hear the president is a changed body. Those who weathered the election have returned with views altered to some degree, and there are many new faces. NBC News correspondent Douglas Kiker reports from Washington.
The president's State of the Union address and the response it receives from Congress represent the opening moves in a most complicated political chess game. A glance at the board as the game begins this year shows that the president is in trouble with Congress. There are differences over the course and the cost of the war in Vietnam. There are differences over domestic politics, too. Is a tax increase necessary? Is even more great society legislation needed this year? Or should 1967 be a year of reflection and inspection, of catching up? The Republicans staged a big political comeback in the elections last November. They gained 47 seats in the House and 3 in the Senate. Some sense that the prevailing mood of the Congress this year will be a conservative one. But this is not a Republican Congress, far from it. The fact is, there is no single definable congressional mood in 1967. As usual, there are many moods, just as there are many moods in the nation itself. There are those in Congress who would like it if the president called for a stronger effort in Vietnam, and there are those who would like it if he came forth with some new dramatic peace move. There are those who would like it if Mr. Johnson recommended even more great society legislation, and there are those who would like it if Mr. Johnson recommended less. And there are those who believe the program should be cut back in scope and cost. Congressional Republicans sense that the record they make in this 90th Congress will have a direct and perhaps even crucial bearing on their chances of success in the 1968 presidential elections. This year, they would like to be not a party of obstruction, but a party of responsible opposition. So there are many moods and many hopes on Capitol Hill tonight. In every case, Congress is waiting now anxiously to see what the president has to say. For an assessment of his mood, here now is NBC White House correspondent Ray Sherriff.
The president will appear tonight as a troubled man, but a determined man, determined to show that his critics, both here and abroad, will not lessen his will to pursue the war in Vietnam or the war against poverty and other ills here at home. The president will come to the House chamber as something of an underdog. His presidency reached its low point after the Republican gains in the November election, when critics closed in on him from all sides. Then came his surgery, his exodus to the ranch in Texas, and a silent period which has persisted more or less to this hour. Some observers feel that because of the underdog role he seems to occupy tonight, he can hope for an extra flow of public sympathy and understanding in the remarks he is about to give and the help he is about to ask for, the help and the sacrifice. One would suppose the president will be confident about the State of the Union, bullish about the economy, but troubled about Vietnam and how long the war there will last. There has been no sign that the president is ready to signal any retreat from his domestic programs, nor has there been any indication he is about to embark on any major new ones, any social or welfare innovations. he can be expected to come out fighting as he outlines programs to build on what he has already enacted. The nation can look for answers tonight to several big questions from this troubled president. Before him is a plan for a $1 billion anti-missile program. Will the United States embark on such a program to keep up with the Soviet Union? And tonight we'll provide an answer to the great economic question which the president has debated for so long. Should the administration call for a tax increase to help pay for Vietnam and hold down inflation? The president speaks tonight as a man at midterm. He intends to be candid when he can. Now is his hour to reassert presidential leadership and to raise the question whether the United States has the will to stand firm in Vietnam. In sum, he is about to show his determination from the greatest rostrum in the nation after a long and uncharacteristic silence. Ray Scherer, NBC White House correspondent.
The basic decision that has been facing President Johnson is whether the war in Vietnam will permit him to advance his welfare programs at home. All other decisions he discloses tonight will stem from how he has resolved this fundamental war versus welfare dilemma. On the war side of the equation, the world will be listening closely for anything the president might have to say regarding chances of peace in Vietnam. Within the Congress, however, the arguments of hawks and doves tend to cancel each other. Thus, the president can, with relative political comfort, pursue a program of pressing the war while searching for peace. Now, still under the heading of war, there must be decisions on how much to ask to pay for the conflict in Vietnam for the remainder of this fiscal year and the next, and what changes, if any, to recommend in the nation's draft procedure. Not limited to Vietnam will be decisions affecting national defense, military equipment, and its cost. So close attention will be paid to what Mr. Johnson may say about building and putting into place a system of anti-ballistic missiles to knock out incoming enemy missiles. Russia, it's believed, is deploying such a system, which threatens to upset the balance of terror and renew the arms race. In view of this, Mr. Johnson must judge his chances of continuing the wary effort to reach understanding and accommodation with the Soviet Union, a process that has been underway since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and on which such matters as a treaty to halt the spread of nuclear weapons and increased trade may hinge. And growing in this climate has been the president's hope of moving toward more nearly normal relations with the communist nations of Eastern and Central Europe. All of this, the war in Vietnam and the new conditions in Europe, have had a pronounced effect calling for new decisions regarding NATO and our relations with our European allies. Now, on the welfare side of the equation, Mr. Johnson has had to decide whether to pull back, hold the line, or enlarge his Great Society program, for which he hopes to be remembered in history. The president has had to make decisions on the Job Corps and Head Start programs, educational programs, retraining programs, and a great many more. And as the president comes before the Congress, hanging over all of this, the war in Vietnam and welfare at home, is the question of the nation's economy and whether a tax increase is needed. On hand in Washington is NBC White House correspondent Ray Scherer.
This is the chamber of the House of Representatives of the Congress of the United States. Congress is in joint session. Speaker John McCormick is at the gavel. Next to him, Vice President Humphrey. This will be President Johnson's fifth appearance as president before such a joint session. At the moment, he is in Speaker John McCormick's office, off the chamber, waiting for his signal to enter. Mrs. Johnson arrived to take her seat in the front row of the balcony about 20 minutes ago. With her, daughter Linda, a number of cabinet wives, and the wives of presidential assistants. This is the door, the center aisle, where the president will enter. History was made in this chamber today. The House refused to seat Adam Clayton Powell. Only the third time this century that such a thing has happened. Vice President Humphrey and members of the Senate arrived about 15 minutes ago. Then came members of the diplomatic corps, ambassador, to take...
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Deschler, parliamentarian, Vice President Humphrey, Speaker John McCormick. Will come from Speaker McCormick. Members of the cabinet up front. Members of the Supreme Court, just opposite the president. Rather a long burst of applause.
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure, the high privilege, and the distinct, and might I say, a personal honor to present to you the President of the United States. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, distinguished members of the Congress, I share with all of you the grief that you feel at the death today of one of the most beloved and respected and effective members of this body, distinguished representative from Rhode Island, Mr. Fogarty. I have come here tonight to report to you that this is a time of testing for our nation. At home, the question is whether we will continue working for better opportunities for all Americans when most Americans are already living better than any people in history. Abroad, the question is whether we have the staying power to fight a very costly war when the objective is limited and the danger to us is seemingly remote. So our test is not whether we shrink from our country's cause when the dangers to us are obvious and close at hand, but rather whether we carry on when they seem obscure and distant. And some think that it is safe to lay down our burdens. I have come tonight to ask this Congress and this nation to resolve that issue. To meet our commitments at home and abroad. To continue to build a better America and to reaffirm this nation's allegiance to freedom. As President Abraham Lincoln said, we must ask where we are and whither we're tending. The last 3 years bear witness to our determination to make this a better country. We have struck down legal barriers to equality. We have improved the education of 7 million deprived children. And this year alone, we have enabled almost 1 million students to go to college. We have brought medical care to older people that were unable to afford it. 3.5 million Americans
have already received treatment under Medicare since July. We have built a strong economy that has put almost 3 million more Americans on the payrolls in the last year alone. We have included more than 9 million new workers under a higher minimum wage. We have launched new training programs to provide job skills for almost 1 million Americans. We have helped more than 1,000 local communities to attack poverty in the neighborhoods of the poor. We have set out to rebuild our cities on a scale that's never attempted before. We have begun to rescue our waters from the menace of pollution and to restore the beauty of our land and our countryside and our cities and our towns. We have given 1 million young Americans a chance to earn through the Neighborhood Youth Corps or through Head Start a chance to learn. So together we have tried to meet the needs of our people, and we have succeeded in creating a better life for the many as well as the few. And now we must answer whether our gains shall be the foundations of further progress or whether they shall be only monuments to what might have been. Abandoned now by people who lack the will to see their great work through. I believe that our people do not want to quit. Though the task is great, the work hard, often frustrating, and success is a matter of days or months, of years, sometimes it may be even decades. But I have come here tonight to discuss with you 5 ways of carrying forward the progress of these last 3 years. And these 5 ways concern programs and partnership and priorities and prosperity and peace. First, programs, we must see to it, I think, that these new programs that we have passed work effectively and are administered in the best possible way. 3 years ago, we set out to create these new instruments of social progress. This required trial and error, and it has produced both. But as we learn through success and failure, we are changing our strategy and we are trying to improve our tactics. In the long run, these starts, some rewarding, others inadequate and disappointing, are crucial to success. One example is the struggle to make life better for the less fortunate among us. On a similar occasion at this rostrum in 1949, I heard a great American president, Harry S. Truman, declare this, and I quote, "The American people have decided that poverty is just as wasteful and just as unnecessary as preventable disease," unquote. Many listened to President Truman that day here in this chamber, but few understood what was required and did anything about it. The executive branch and the Congress waited 15 long years before ever taking any action on that challenge, as it did on many other challenges that great president presented. And when 3 years ago, you here in the Congress joined with me in a declaration of war on poverty, then I warn, and I quote, "It will not be a short or an easy struggle. No single weapon will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won." come here to renew that pledge tonight. I recommend that we intensify our efforts to give the poor a chance to enjoy and to join in this nation's progress. I shall propose certain administrative changes suggested by the Congress, as well as some that we have learned from our own trial and error. I shall urge special methods and special funds to reach the hundreds of thousands of Americans that are now trapped in the ghettos of our big cities, and through Head Start to try to reach out to our very young little children. The chance to learn is their brightest hope and must command our full determination. For learning brings skills, and skills bring jobs, and jobs bring responsibility and dignity, as well as taxes. This war, like the war in Vietnam, is not a simple one. There is no single battle line which you can plot each day on a chart. The enemy is not easy to perceive, or to isolate, or to destroy. There are mistakes and there are setbacks, but we are moving, and our direction is forward. This is true with other programs that are making and breaking new ground. Some do not yet have the capacity to absorb well or wisely all the money that could be put into them. Administrative skills and trained manpower are just as vital to their success as dollars. And I believe those skills will come. But it will take time and patience and hard work. Success cannot be forced at a single stroke. So we must continue to strengthen the administration of every program if that success is to come, as we know that it must. We have done much in the space of 2 short years working together. I have recommended, and you, the Congress, have approved 10 different reorganization plans, combining and consolidating many bureaus of this government and creating 2 entirely new cabinet departments. And I have come tonight to propose that we establish a new department, a Department of Business and Labor. By combining the Department of Commerce with the Department of Labor and other related agencies, I think that we can create a more economical, efficient, and streamlined instrument that will better serve a growing nation. This is our goal throughout the entire federal government. Every program will be thoroughly evaluated. Grant and aid programs will be improved and simplified, as desired by many of our local administrators and our governors. Where there have been mistakes, we will try very hard to correct them. Where there has been progress, we will try to build upon it. Our second objective is partnership, to create an effective partnership at all levels of government. And I should treasure nothing more than to have that partnership begin between the executive and the Congress. The 88th and 89th Congress passed more social and economic legislation than any single 2 Congresses in American history. Most of you who were members of those Congresses voted to pass most of those measures. But your efforts will come to nothing unless it reaches the people. Federal energy is essential, but it is not enough. Only a total working partnership among federal, state, and local governments can succeed. The test of that partnership will be the concern of each public organization, each private institution, and each responsible citizen. Each state and county and city needs to examine its capacity for government in today's world, as we are examining ours in the executive department, and as I see you are examining yours, some will need to reorganize and reshape their methods of administration, as we are doing. Others will need to revise their constitutions and their laws to bring them up to date, as we are doing. Above all, I think we must work together and find ways in which the multitudes of small jurisdictions can be brought together more efficiently. During the past 3 years, we have returned to state and local governments about $40 billion in grants and aid. This year alone, 70% of our federal expenditures for domestic programs will be distributed through the state and the local government. With federal assistance, state and local governments by 1970 will be spending close to $110 billion annually. These enormous sums must be used wisely, honestly, and effectively. We intend to work closely with the states and the localities to do exactly that. Our third objective is priorities, to move ahead on the priorities that we've established within the resources that are available. I wish, of course, that we could do all that should be done, and that we could do it now. But the nation has many commitments and responsibilities which make heavy demand upon our total resources. No administration would more eagerly utilize for these programs all the resources they require than the administration that started them. So let us resolve now to do all that we can with what we have, knowing that it is far, far more than we have ever done before, and far, far less than our problems will ultimately require. Let us create new opportunities for our children and our young Americans who need special help. We should strengthen the Head Start program, begin it for children 3 years old, and maintain its educational momentum by following through in the early years. We should try new methods of child development and care from the earliest years before it's too late to correct. And I will propose these measures to the 90th Congress. Let us ensure that older Americans and neglected Americans share in their nation's progress. We should raise Social Security payments by an overall average of 20%. That will add $4.1 billion to Social Security payments in the first year. I will recommend that each of the 23 million Americans now receiving payments get an increase of at least 15%. I will ask that you raise the minimum payments by 59% from $44 to $70 a month, and to guarantee a minimum benefit of $100 a month for those with a total of 25 years of coverage. We must raise the limits that retired workers can earn without losing Social Security income. We must eliminate by law unjust discrimination in employment because of age. We should embark upon a major effort to provide self-help assistance to the forgotten in our midst, the American Indians and the migratory farm workers. And we should reach with the hand of understanding to help those who live in rural poverty. And I will propose these measures to the 90th Congress. So let us keep on improving the quality of life and enlarging the meaning of justice for all of our fellow Americans. We should transform our decaying slums into places of decency through the landmark Model Cities program. And I intend to seek for this effort this year the full amount that you in Congress authorized last year. We should call upon the genius of private industry and the most advanced technology to help rebuild our great cities. We should vastly expand the fight for clean air with a total attack on pollution at its sources. And because air, like water, does not respect man-made boundaries, we shall set up regional airsheds throughout this great land. We should continue to carry every corner of the nation our campaign for a beautiful America, to clean up our towns, to make them more beautiful, our cities, our countryside, by creating more parks and more seashores and more open spaces for our children to play in and for the generations that come after us to enjoy. We should continue to seek equality and justice for each citizen before a jury, in seeking a job, in exercising his civil rights. We should find a solution to fair housing, so that every American, regardless of color, has a decent home of his choice. We should modernize our selective service system. The National Commission on Selective Service will shortly submit its report. I will send you new recommendations to meet our military manpower needs. But let us resolve that this is to be the Congress that made our draft laws as fair and as effective as possible. We should protect what Justice Brandeis called the, quote, right most valued by civilized men, unquote. The right to privacy. We should outlaw all wiretapping, public and private. Wherever and whenever it occurs, except when the security of this nation itself is at stake, and only then with the strictest governmental safeguard. And we should exercise the full reach of our constitutional powers to outlaw electronic bugging and snooping. I hope this Congress will try to help me do more for the consumer. We should demand that the cost of credit be clearly and honestly expressed where average citizens can understand it. We should immediately take steps to prevent massive power failures, to safeguard the home against hazardous household products, and to assure safety in the pipelines that carry natural gas across our nation. We should extend Medicare benefits that are now denied to 1,300,000 permanently and totally disabled Americans under 65 years of age. We should improve the process of democracy by passing our election reform and financing proposals, by tightening our laws regulating lobbying, and by restoring a reasonable franchise to Americans who move their residences. We should develop educational television into a vital public resource to enrich our homes, educate our families, and to provide assistance in our classrooms. And we should insist that the public interest be fully served through the public's airways. And I will propose these measures to the 90th Congress. And now we come to a question that weighs very heavily on all of our minds, on yours and mine. This nation must make an all-out effort to combat crime. The 89th Congress gave us a new start in the attack on crime by passing the Law Enforcement Assistance Act that I recommended. We appointed the National Crime Commission to study crime in America and to recommend the best ways to carry that attack forward. And while we do not have all the answers on the basis of its preliminary recommendations, we are ready to move. This is not a war that Washington alone can win. The idea of a national police force is repugnant to the American people. Crime must be rooted out in local communities by local authorities. But our policemen must be better trained and must be better paid and must be better supported by the local citizens that they try to serve and to protect. The national government can and expects to help. And so I will recommend to the 90th Congress the Safe Streets and Crime Control Act of 1967. It will enable us to assist those states and cities that try to make their streets and their homes safer, and their police forces better, and their correction system more effective, and their courts more efficient. And when the Congress approves, the federal government will be able to provide a substantial percentage of the cost, 90% of the cost, for developing the state and local plan, master plan to combat crime in their area, 60% of the cost of training new tactical units and developing instant communications and special alarm systems and introducing the latest equipment and techniques so that they can become weapons in the war on crime, and 50% of the cost of building crime laboratories and police academy-type centers so that our citizens can be protected by the best trained and served by the best equipped police to be found anywhere. We will also recommend new methods to prevent juvenile delinquents from becoming adult delinquents. And we'll seek new partnerships with states and cities in order to deal with this hideous narcotics problem. And we'll recommend strict control on the sale of firearms. At the heart of this attack on crime must be the conviction that a free America, as Abraham Lincoln once said, must, and I quote, "Let reverence for the laws become the political religion of the nation," unquote. Our country's laws must be respected. Order must be maintained. will support, with all the constitutional powers the President possesses, our nation's law enforcement officials in their attempt to control the crime and the violence that tear the fabric of our communities. Many of these priority proposals will be built on foundations that have already been laid. Some will necessarily be small at first, but every beginning is a consequence. And if we postpone this urgent work now, it will simply have to be done later. And later we'll pay a much higher price. Our fourth objective is prosperity. To keep our economy moving ahead steadily and safely. We have now enjoyed 6 years of unprecedented and rewarding prosperity. Last year, 1966, wages were the highest in history. And the unemployment rate, announced yesterday, reached the lowest point in 13 years. The total after-tax income of the American families after taxes rose nearly 5%. The corporate profits after taxes rose a little more than 5%. Our gross national product advanced 5.5% to about $740 billion. Income per farm went up 6%. Now, we have been greatly concerned because consumer prices rose 4.5% over the 18 months since we decided to send troops to Vietnam. This was more than we had expected. And the government tried to do everything that we knew how to do to hold it down. Yet, we were not as successful as we wished to be. In the 18 months after we entered World War II, prices rose not 4.5%, but 13.5%. In the first 18 months after Korea, the conflict broke out there, prices rose not 4.5%, but 11%. Now, during those two periods, we had OPA price controls that the Congress gave us, War Labor Board wage controls. Since Vietnam, we have not asked for those controls, and we have tried to avoid imposing. We believe that we have done better, but we make no pretense having been successful or done as well as we wished. Our greatest disappointment in the economy during 1966 was the excessive rise in interest rates and the tightening of credit. They imposed very severe and very unfair burdens on our home buyers and on our home builders and all those associated with the home industry. Last January, and again last September, I recommended fiscal and moderate tax measures to try to restrain the unbalanced pace of economic expansion. Legislatively and administratively, we took several billions out of the economy. And with these measures, in both instances, the Congress approved most of the recommendations rather promptly. As 1966 ended, price stability was seemingly being restored. Wholesale prices are lower tonight than they were in August. So are retail food prices. Monetary conditions are also easing. Most interest rates have retreated from their earlier peaks. More money now seems to be available. And given the cooperation of the Federal Reserve System, which I so earnestly seek, I am confident that this movement can continue. And I pledge the American people that I will do everything in a president's power to lower interest rates and to ease money in this country. The Federal Home Loan Bank Board tomorrow morning will announce that it will make immediately available to savings and loans associations an additional $1 billion. And it will lower from 6% to 5.75% the interest rate charged on those loans. We shall continue on a sensible course of fiscal and budgetary policy that we believe will keep our economy growing without new inflationary spirals, that will finance responsibly the needs of our men in Vietnam and the progress of our people at home, that will support a significant movement in our export surplus, and will press forward toward easier credit and toward lower interest rates. I recommend to the Congress a surcharge of 6% on both corporate and individual income taxes to last for 2 years, or for so long as the unusual expenditures associated with our efforts in Vietnam continue. I will promptly recommend an earlier termination date if a reduction in these expenditures permitted. This surcharge will raise revenues by some $4.5 billion in the first year. For example, a person whose income tax, whose tax payment the tax he owes is $1,000, he will pay under this proposal an extra $60 over the 12-month period, or $5 a month. The overwhelming majority of Americans who pay taxes today are below that figure, and they will pay substantially less than $5 a month. Married couples with two children with incomes up to $5,000 per year will be exempt from this tax, as will single people with an income of up to $1,900 a year. Now, if the Americans today still paid the income and excise tax rates in effect when I came into the presidency in the year 1964, their annual taxes would have been over $20 billion more than at present tax rates. So this proposal is that while we have this problem and this emergency in Vietnam, while we're trying to meet the needs of our people at home, your government asks for slightly more than one-fourth of that tax cut each year in order to try to hold our budget deficit in fiscal 1968 within prudent limits, and to give our country and to give our fighting men the help they need in this hour of trial. For fiscal 1967, we estimate the budget expenditures to be $126.7 billion. And revenues of $117 billion. That will leave us a deficit this year of $9.7 billion. For fiscal 1968, we estimate the budget expenditures of $135 billion. And with the tax measures recommended and a continuing strong economy, we estimate revenues will be $126.9 billion. The deficit then will be $8.1 billion. I will very soon forward all of my recommendations to the Congress. Yours is the responsibility to discuss and to debate them, to approve or modify or reject them. I welcome your views, as I have welcomed working with you 30 years as a colleague and as vice president and president. I should like to say to the members of the opposition, whose numbers, if I am not mistaken, seem to have increased somewhat, that the genius of the American political system has always been best expressed through creative debate that offers choices and reasonable alternatives. Throughout our history, great Republicans and Democrats have seemed to understand this. So let there be light and reason in our relations. That is the way to a responsible session and a responsive government. Let us be remembered as a president and a Congress who tried to improve the quality of life for every American, not just the rich, not just the poor, but every man, woman, and child in this great nation of ours. We all go to school, to good schools or bad schools. We all take air into our lungs, clean air or polluted air. We all drink water, pure water or polluted water. We all face sickness someday, and some more often than we wish, and old age as well. We all have a stake in this great society, in its economic growth, in reduction of civil strife, a great stake in good government. And we just must not arrest the pace of progress that we've established in this country in these years. So our children's children will pay the price if we're not wise enough and courageous enough and determined enough to stand up and meet the nation's needs as well as we can in the time allotted us. Abroad as at home, there's also risk in change. But abroad as at home, there is a greater risk in standing still. No part of our foreign policy is so sacred that it ever remains beyond review. We shall be flexible where conditions in the world change and where man's efforts can change them for the better. We're in the midst of a great transition, a transition from narrow nationalism to international partnership, from the harsh spirit of the Cold War to the hopeful spirit of common humanity on a troubled and a threatened planet. In Latin America, the American chiefs of state will be meeting very shortly to give our hemispheric policies new direction. We've come a long way in this hemisphere since the inter-American effort in economic and social development was launched for the conference at Bogota in 1960 under the leadership of President Eisenhower. The Alliance for Progress moved dramatically forward under President Kennedy. There is new confidence that the voice of the people is being heard, that the dignity of the individual is stronger than ever in this hemisphere. And we're facing up to and meeting many of the hemispheric problems together. This hemisphere, that reform under democracy can be made to happen because it has happened. So together, I think, we must now move to strike down the barriers to full cooperation among the American nations, to free the energies and the resources of two great continents on behalf of all of our citizens. Africa stands at an earlier stage of development than Latin America. It has yet to develop the transportation and communications and agriculture, and above all, the trained men and women, without which growth is impossible. There, too, the job will best be done if the nations and the people of Africa cooperate on a regional basis. More and more, our programs for Africa are going to be directed toward self-help. The future of Africa is shattered by unsolved racial conflicts. Our policy will continue to reflect our basic commitments as a people to support those that are prepared to work towards cooperation and harmony between races, to help those who demand change but reject the fool's gold of violence. In the Middle East, the spirit of goodwill toward all, unfortunately, has not yet taken hold. An already tortured peace seems to be constantly threatened. We shall try to use our influence to increase the possibilities of improved relations among the nations of that region, and we are working hard at that task. In the great subcontinent of South Asia, live more than a sixth of the Earth's population. Over the years, we and others have invested very heavily in capital and food for the economic development of India and Pakistan. We are not prepared to see our assistance wasted, however, in conflict. It must strengthen their capacity to help themselves. It must help these two nations, who both are friends, to overcome poverty and to emerge as self-reliant leaders and find terms for reconciliation and cooperation. In Western Europe, we shall maintain in NATO an integrated common defense. But we also look forward to the time when greater security can be achieved through measures of arms control and disarmament and through other forms of practical agreement. We are shaping a new future of enlarged partnership in nuclear affairs, in economic and technical cooperation, in trade negotiations, in political consultation, and in working together with the governments and peoples of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The emerging spirit of confidence is precisely what we hoped to achieve when we went to work a generation ago to put our shoulder to the wheel and try to help rebuild Europe. We faced new challenges and opportunities then and there, and we faced also some dangers. But I believe that the peoples on both sides of the Atlantic, as well as both sides of this chamber, wanted to face them together. Our relations with the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, are also in transition. We have avoided both the acts and the rhetoric of the Cold War. When we have differed with the Soviet Union, or other nations for that matter, I have tried to differ quietly and with courtesy and without venom. Our objective is not to continue the Cold War, but to end it. We have signed an agreement to the United Nations on the peaceful uses of outer space. We have agreed to open direct air flights with the Soviet Union. We have removed more than 400 non-strategic items from export control. We are determined that the Export-Import Bank can allow commercial credits to Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia, as well as to Romania and Yugoslavia. We have entered into a cultural agreement with the Soviet Union for another 2 years. We have agreed with Bulgaria and Hungary to upgrade our legations to embassies. We have started discussions with international agencies on ways of increasing contacts with Eastern European countries. This administration has taken these steps even as duty compelled us to fulfill and execute alliances and treaty obligations throughout the world that were entered into before I became president. So tonight, I now ask and urge this Congress to help our foreign and our commercial trade policies by passing an East-West trade bill and by approving our consular convention with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union has in the past year increased its long-range missile capabilities. It has begun to place near Moscow a limited anti-missile defense. My first responsibility to our people is to assure that no nation can ever find it rational to launch a nuclear attack or to use its nuclear power as a credible threat against us or against our allies. I would emphasize that that is why an important link between Russia and the United States is in our common interest in arms control and in disarmament. We have the solemn duty to slow down the arms race between us, if that is at all possible, in both conventional and nuclear weapons and defenses. And I thought we were making some progress in that direction the first few months I was in office. And I realized that any additional race would impose on our peoples, and on all mankind for that matter, an additional waste of resources with no gain in security to either side. I expect in the days ahead to closely consult and seek the advice of the Congress about the possibilities of international agreements bearing directly upon this problem. First, the developing nations must give highest priority to food production, including the use of technology and the capital of private enterprise. Second, nations with food deficits must put more of their resources into voluntary family planning programs. And third, the developed nations must all assist other nations to avoid starvation in the short run, and to move rapidly towards the ability to feed themselves. Every member of the world community now bears a direct responsibility to help bring our most basic human account into balance. I come now finally to Southeast Asia, and to Vietnam in particular. Soon I will submit to the Congress a detailed report on that situation. Tonight, I want to just review the essential points as briefly as I can. We are in Vietnam because the United States of America and our allies are committed by the CITO Treaty to, quote, act to meet the common danger of aggression in Southeast Asia. We are in Vietnam because an international agreement signed by the United States, North Vietnam, and others in 1962 is being systematically violated by the communists. That violation threatens the independence of all the small nations in Southeast Asia and threatens the peace of the entire region and perhaps the world. We are there because the people of South Vietnam have as much right to remain non-communist, if that is what they choose, as North Vietnam has to remain communist. We are there because the Congress has pledged by solemn vote to take all necessary measures to prevent further aggression. No better words could describe our present course than those once spoken by the great Thomas Jefferson. It is the melancholy law of human societies to be compelled sometimes to choose a great evil in order to ward off a greater evil. We have chosen to fight a limited war in Vietnam in an attempt to prevent a larger war, a war that almost certain to follow, I believe, if the communists succeeded and overrunning and taking over South Vietnam by aggression and by force. I believe, and I am supported by some authority, that if they are not checked now, the world can expect to pay a greater price to check them later. That's what our statesmen said when they debated this treaty. And that's why it was ratified 82-1 by the Senate many years ago. You'll remember that we stood in Western Europe 20 years ago. Is there anyone in this chamber tonight who doubts that the course of freedom was not changed for the better because of the courage of that stand? 16 years ago, we and others stopped another kind of aggression. This time it was in Korea. And imagine how different Asia might be today if we had failed to act when the Communist Army of North Korea marched south. The Asia of tomorrow will be far different because we have said in Vietnam, as we said 16 years ago in Korea, this far and no further. I think I reveal no secrets when I tell you that we are dealing with a stubborn adversary that's committed to the use of force and terror to settle political questions. I wish I could report to you that the conflict is almost over. This I cannot do. We face more cost, more loss, and more agony. For the end is not yet. I cannot promise you that it will come this year or come next year. Our adversary still believes, I think, tonight, that he can go on fighting longer than we can and longer than we and our allies will be prepared to stand up and resist. Our men in that area, there are nearly 500,000 now, have borne well the burden and the heat of the day. Their efforts have deprived the communist enemy of the victory that he sought and that he expected a year ago. We have steadily frustrated his main forces. General Westmoreland reports that the enemy can no longer succeed on the battlefield. Our pressure. I must say to you that our pressure must be sustained and will be sustained until he realizes that the war he started is costing him more than he can ever gain. I know of no strategy more likely to attain that end than the strategy of accumulating slowly but inexorably every kind of material resource, of laboriously teaching troops the very elements of their trade. That and patience. And I mean a great deal of patience. Our South Vietnamese allies are also being tested tonight because they must provide real security to the people that are living in the countryside. And this means reducing the terrorism and the armed attacks, which kidnapped and killed 26,900 civilians in the last 32 months, to levels where they can be successfully controlled by the regular South Vietnamese security forces. It means bringing to the villagers an effective civilian government that they can respect and that they can rely upon and that they can participate in and that they can have a personal stake in their government. We hope that government is now beginning to emerge. While I cannot report the desired progress in the pacification effort, the very distinguished and able Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge reports that South Vietnam is turning to this task with a new sense of urgency. And we can help, but only they can win this part of the war. Their task is to build and protect a new life in each rural province. One result of our stand in Vietnam is already clear. It is this. The peoples of Asia now know that the door to independence is not going to be slammed shut. They know that it is possible for them to choose their own national destinies without coercion. The performance of our men in Vietnam, backed by the American people, has created a feeling of confidence and unity among the independent nations of Asia and the Pacific. I saw it in their faces in the 19 days that I spent in their homes and in their country. Fear of external communist conquest in many Asian nations is already subsiding. And with this, the spirit of hope is rising. For the first time in history, a common outlook and common institutions are already emerging. This forward movement is rooted in the ambitions and the interests of Asian nations themselves. It was precisely this movement that we hoped to accelerate when I spoke at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore in April 1965, and I pledged a much more massive effort to improve the life of man in that part of the world, in the hope that we could take some of the funds that we were spending on bullets and bombs and spend on schools and production. 20 months later, our efforts have produced a new reality. The doors of the billion-dollar Asian bank that I recommended to the Congress and you endorsed almost unanimously, I'm proud to tell you, are already open. Asians are engaged tonight in regional efforts in a dozen new directions. Their hopes are high. Their faith is strong. Their confidence is deep. And even as the war continues, we shall play our part in carrying forward this constructive, historic development. As recommended by the Eugene Black Mission, and if other nations will join us, I will seek a special authorization from the Congress of $200 million for East Asian regional programs, because we are eager to turn our resources to peace. Our efforts in behalf of humanity, I think, need not be restricted by any parallel or by any boundary line. The moment that peace comes, as I pledged in Baltimore, I will ask the Congress for funds to join in an international program of reconstruction and development for all the people of Vietnam and their deserving neighbors who wish our help. We shall continue to hope for a reconciliation between the people of mainland China and the world community, including working together in all the tasks of armed control and security and progress on which the fate of the Chinese people, like their fellow men elsewhere, depends. We would be the first to welcome a China which decided to respect her neighbors' rights. We would be the first to applaud her, were she to apply her great energies and intelligence to improving the welfare of her people. And we have no intention of trying to deny her legitimate needs for security and friendly relations with her neighboring countries. Our hope that all of this will someday happen rests on the conviction that we, the American people and our allies, will and are going to see Vietnam through to an honorable peace. We will support all appropriate initiatives by the United Nations and others, which can bring the several parties together for unconditional discussion of peace anywhere, anytime. And we will continue to take every possible initiative ourselves to constantly probe for peace. And until such efforts succeed, or until the infiltration ceases, or until the conflict subsides, I think the course of wisdom for this country is that we just must firmly pursue our present course. We will stand firm in Vietnam. I think you know that our fighting men there tonight bear the heaviest burden of all. With their lives, they serve this nation, and we must give them nothing less than our full support. And we have given them that. Nothing less than the determination that Americans have always given their fighting men. Whatever our sacrifice here, even if it's more than $5 a month, it's small compared to their own. How long? How long it will take, I cannot prophesy. I only know that the will of the American people, I think, is tonight being tested. Whether we can fight a war of limited objectives over a period of time and keep alive the hope of independence and stability for people other than ourselves, whether we can continue to act with restraint when the temptation to get it over with is inviting but dangerous, whether we can accept the necessity of choosing a great evil in order to ward off a greater one, whether we can do these without arousing the hatreds and the passions that are ordinarily loosed in time of war. On all these questions, so much turns. The answers will determine not only where we are, but whither we are tending. A time of testing. Yes. And a time of transition. The transition is sometimes slow. Sometimes unpopular. Almost always very painful, and often quite dangerous. But we have lived with danger for a long time before, and we shall live with it for a long time yet to come. We know that man is born unto trouble. We also know that this nation was not forged and did not survive and grow and prosper without a great deal of sacrifice from a great many men. And for all the disorders that we must deal with, and all the frustrations that concern us, and all the anxieties that we're called upon to resolve, for all the issues we must face with the agony that attends them, let us remember that those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigues of supporting it. But let us also count not only our burdens, but our blessings, for there are many. And let us give thanks to the one who governs us all. Let us draw encouragement from the signs of hope, for they too are many. Let us remember that we've been tested before, and America has never been found wanting. So, with your understanding, I would hope your confidence and your support. We are going to persist, and we are going to succeed.
For an hour and 10 minutes, he was applauded 40 times. There's a good deal of news in this speech. Most people did not expect his call for a tax increase. The president proposes to increase for 2 years the federal income tax bills of most individuals and businesses, a surcharge of 6% on what you pay now. This is not the same thing as a 6% tax increase. In fact, it is much less. It is a 6% tax on top of your present tax bill. It would bring in $4.5 billion the first year. The president said it is needed to hold the deficit down and give the men in Vietnam the help they need. Shaking hands with Senator Dixon, Margaret J. Smith. What it means is this. If you pay $1,000 in taxes, you would then pay an extra $60. Married couples with two children with incomes up to $5,000 would be exempt, as well as single people with incomes up to $1,900. Another major point in the speech, the president will ask Congress to increase Social Security benefits by an overall average of 20%. On the international situation, perhaps the major point is that the president will not deploy anti-ballistic missiles to meet the Russians. Rather, he will pursue negotiations toward arms control. On Vietnam, he struck a note of determination, said we face more cost, more loss, more agony. He called for patience, for rejecting the temptation to get it over with. Here are the other high points. An all-out crime program, a complete ban on wiretapping, combining the Labor and Commerce Departments into one, expanding the Head Start program for children, intensifying the poverty program, a consumers program, civil rights legislation, but apparently nothing new here, election reform, and making the draft more effective. Many of these things he did not spell out. The theme of his speech was that the nation and the world are in transition. The president called for partnership on both fronts. Ray Scherer, NBC White House correspondent, now back to Frank McGee.
And one of the questions now is how Congress feels about what the president has proposed, what the Republican and Democratic leaders of the legislative branch think the president will be able to achieve, and we will hear directly from them in Washington in a moment. In addition, we have in studios in London representatives of the government of Great Britain and France, and we're anxious to hear their response to Mr. Johnson's address. Further, we have in London and in New York figures well qualified to support opposing views on proposals that Mr. Johnson made affecting the Great Society. We propose first to discuss some of those proposals that Mr. Johnson made affecting us domestically, in short, the Great Society. With me in New York is NBC News correspondent Edwin Newman, and also Mr. Raymond Saulnier, professor of economics at Barnard and once an advisor to former President Eisenhower. And by satellite from our studios in London, we shall be hearing from Mr. John Kenneth Galbraith, professor of economics at Harvard and once an advisor to the late President Kennedy. And Professor Galbraith, I'd like to begin with you if I could. It seemed to me that the president did not chart much of a new course for his Great Society. I'd like to ask if you agree with that, and whether you do or not, what your response to his remarks in this area were.
Substantial increase, as I understood the speech, a very substantial increase in the funds for the important programs that have now been started. Things, for example, like Head Start, the Job Corps. You notice that he started with the poverty program. And in a way, all these measures in the last 2 or 3 years were initiated somewhat on a trial basis, so that the problem at the moment is not to reach out into new things, but to do what we are already doing on a much larger scale. And this also is true, of course, of the cities, the Model Cities program, the other things that the president mentioned. So one shouldn't, I think, in all fairness to the president, suppose for a moment that he's abandoning the Great Society program simply because he hasn't come up with a large number of new items. The thing to watch is when the budget comes, so how much money gets into the needed efforts that we now have underway.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the question is whether the president is going to get the money that he's asked for.
And on that point, of course, the tax increase he asked for is a very important matter. In fact, it's probably the most important thing in the speech. Would you agree with that, Professor Sumner?
Well, I'm awfully glad to see that tax increase. Yes, this was not only important for the stability of the economy, and it's also important to take some of the pressure off of the interest rates, so it becomes possible, if one increases taxes, to reduce interest rates a bit. But it's also to get out from under one of the most egregious pieces of nonsense that we've been subject to in recent years, which is that although personal incomes are at an all-time high, and though they're at an all-time high, partly as the result of the war in Vietnam, the war in Vietnam makes it impossible to spend on behalf of the poor and the needy.
Professor Galbraith, I'd like at this point to put a question to Professor Sonnier to find out whether he agrees with you that the tax increase is desirable.
Well, I think the tax increase at this time is a very risky enterprise. And I think this is really the big surprise in the president's message.
What do you find risky in it, Professor Sonnier?
What I find risky in it is that the economy right at the moment is rather on the soft side. It's hard to find a general index of economic activity right now that isn't either flat or tending down just a bit.
You think it will depress the economy?
Well, this is what we've been taught by the new economics, and this is what economics teaches us generally. This is what we have a tax increase for under any circumstances, is to deflate, retard, to restrict, to hold back an economy. And I think it's what it'll do in this case.
May I interrupt to ask you if you agree with the position the president took on his Great Society proposals? Do you think he should have done more about what he did or less?
Well, Mr. McGee, the problem here is not whether we should do more, it seems to me, on the Great Society or any other program. The problem is, how are we going to finance what we are doing? And the difficulty that the president has, and we must all sympathize with him in this, is that he needs more tax money. But with the economy and the condition that he's in, if he asks for it, he may in fact get less. Because if the economy turns down as a result of a tax increase, then we're going to get less revenue. So you may get an even larger deficit as a result.
We wish to thank Professor Galbraith in London and you, Dr. Sonnier, here in New York. I would like to discuss at least briefly some of the foreign policy aspects of President Johnson's State of the Union address. And again, by satellite, we will hear from, who is in our studios in London, Mr. Reginald Maudling, former Chancellor of the Exchequer and now a Deputy Leader of the British Conservative Party, and Monsieur Jean-Claude Servan-Schreiber, a member of the French Chamber of Deputies and Assistant Secretary General of the Gaullist Party. And I think you have a question, Ed.
Yes, I'd like to know whether Mr. Maudling would agree that the president's speech, so far as foreign policy was concerned, was dominated by the Vietnam issue and whether, in fact, there was nothing else of much substance in it. Would you agree with that, Mr. Maudling?
No, I think it was dominated by the Vietnam issue, and of course, quite rightly, because that is the dominant issue. But what he said about Africa, I found extremely interesting. The Middle East, Pakistan, India, is a very broad view of policy. I found it, incidentally, a very heartening one. His concentration on the growth of the American economy and the maintenance of American determination in Southeast Asia. Both, I think, things of immense importance to the whole Western world.
What about Monsieur Servan-Schreiber? What did he think of the references to Vietnam? Monsieur Servan-Schreiber, as I understand it, is a Gaullist deputy.
Yes, sir. Well, I think, of course, the whole of your policy is dominated by this Vietnam War. There is one thing that I do not quite understand in President Johnson's speech. He held out a hand to the Soviet Union and he asked the Congress to vote this East-West Trade Bill and Cultural Convention with the United States on one hand. Therefore, meaning that it's putting an end to the Cold War with the Soviet Union. He held out a hand to China, recognizing that China has its own right to its national security and asking for a reconciliation, I'm quoting, a reconciliation with mainland China. Therefore, I do not quite understand why there is this sort of ambiguity about this unity of the communist world. The communist world is no longer united. So why choose this, the motive of the war against Vietnam, as a war against communism?
You think it is not a war against communism, Monsieur Servan Schreiber?
No. I think it's something quite different. There's another thing I don't quite understand. President Johnson said, why don't we leave the people of Vietnam live the way they want? The South Vietnamese can live in one way, and the North Vietnamese can be communists if they wish. But I thought that there was in the 1954 Geneva Agreement a measure taken to organize elections in the whole of Vietnam and see whether the Vietnamese really want to live that way.
It is fair to say, then, that you were much disappointed in the speech, but that Mr. Modling was not, and Mr. Modling...
I'm rather disappointed on the Vietnamese point of view. President Johnson says in his conclusion that he will persist and succeed. I recognize that he is persisting. I doubt whether he will succeed.
And Mr. Modling, did you get the impression that the United States is still very concerned about the affairs of Europe, or do they seem to you to be rather overshadowed by the attention paid to Vietnam?
I think they were overshadowed by the attention paid to Vietnam, but that, of course, is understandable in view of the enormous commitment you have to the Vietnam struggle, which I incidentally do regard as a struggle against aggressive communism, an invasion of South Vietnam by North Vietnam. I think it's only fair to say I believe there will be quite a lot of disappointment that the president couldn't feel it possible to take some new initiative in the Vietnam field, possibly, for example, suggesting a cessation of bombing on the assumption that the North Vietnamese would respond in kind.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much. We appreciate your coming to the studios in London and participating in this discussion with us. One had expected the president to say at least something on the question of deploying a system of anti-ballistic missiles. As we said earlier in the program, it is thought that the Soviet Union is doing this, and if the United States elects to do it, then we have a new round in the arms race. The president disclosed what his decision was, to try to negotiate with the Soviet Union on this question rather than undertaking the enormously expensive program of building and putting those missiles in place. Here with some thoughts on that is NBC News correspondent Chet Huntley.
President Johnson tonight offered the Russians a new opportunity to slow down the arms race. A few weeks ago, Secretary of Defense McNamara alerted the nation to the possibility that the Soviet Union was in the process of upsetting the delicate balance of missile deterrence by building a system of defenses against missiles. It was obvious that our spy-in-the-sky satellites had photographed the Russians constructing some unique missile sites, perhaps anti-missile missiles. The United States' response to this possible development in the Soviet Union rested with the president. And in some respects, it was the most awesome item competing for a place in the new budget. New missiles designed to penetrate any enemy defense, or a missile defense system of our own, or both, could cost uncalculated billions of dollars, dwarfing the cost of Vietnam or the domestic economic and social programs. If the Russians had escalated the balance of missile terror and had set off a new arms race, what alternative did we have other than to respond and take up the challenge? The American response, it was reasoned, would be contained in the budget and probably in the President's State of the Union message tonight. But this evening, President Johnson indicated strongly that this country will not engage in any all-out missile defense system now. He said the Soviet system is thus far limited to a ring around the city of Moscow. The president said that while he has a duty to ensure the defense of the United States, he also has a duty to contribute what he can to Soviet-American reduction of arms.
The president also strongly implied that he will offer a new civil rights bill to Congress, a bill that would seek to achieve some of the things he has asked for in the past and has not succeeded in getting. Here with some thoughts on that is NBC News correspondent David Brinkley.
The president's only reference to civil rights was brief, vague, and perfunctory. And that showed, as well as anything does, how much of the electricity and excitement have gone out of the civil rights movement since an earlier presidential speech to Congress. That was when he made a strong emotional appeal using the same phrase used by Negro leaders themselves. We shall overcome. Well, there was none of that tonight. Nothing remotely like that. He said, quote, we should continue to seek equality and justice for each citizen before a jury in seeking a job, in exercising his civil rights. we should find a solution to fair housing so every American, regardless of color, can find a decent home of his choice. Unquote. That's all there was. The difference between this speech to Congress and an earlier one clearly is a compound of Watts, Stokely Carmichael, and all of the other events and personalities in between, plus the election last November, which the Democrats lost to a great extent for racial reasons. So the steam has gone out of it, the excitement is gone, the broad public support civil rights once had is gone. Sometime the problem has to be solved because the alternative is disaster. But there is no doubt the president was reflecting the current mood of many of the American people when he skimmed lightly over the subject in just 46 words.
We have heard what the president proposed in his State of the Union address, and we've discussed some of the foreign and domestic ramifications of these proposals. But as Washington correspondents love to say, the president proposes, but Congress disposes. A report now on the president's chances of getting what he asked for. Again, Douglas Kiker.
There was much in the president's address which his fellow Democrats can and probably will support. More money for poverty, a proposal to outlaw wiretapping, increased Social Security benefits, and a vague promise to try again for some sort of open housing law. But the Republicans got plenty of material to work with, too. No big new legislative proposals, but plans to expand present programs, and the Republicans are sure to find areas where they will say cuts can be made. A $135 billion budget. Big enough for the Republicans to criticize, but small enough to sustain their charge that the administration, again, is failing to reveal the true cost of the war in Vietnam. The three most controversial items were Vietnam. He said nothing new, really, and thus did not change the rules of the congressional debate that's sure to come this year. The anti-ballistic missile. He did not recommend money to start construction of such a system, and many in Congress will think that he should. Certainly legislation to do so is bound to be introduced. And finally, the tax increased. Some will say it's still not enough. Some will say that it came too late. And some will say that it's not needed now. No big surprises, but plenty of food to feed the controversy on Capitol Hill in 1967. Douglas Kiker, NBC News, on Capitol Hill.
As we suggested earlier, much of what the president achieves will depend on the mood, both of the Republicans and Democrats in Congress. It is, after all, a separate branch of government, the legislative versus the executive. The president made an earnest appeal tonight for cooperation between the two. Here is Senator Dirksen.
What was your general impression of the president's address?
Well, first, with respect to your question, let me say, to make a good, constructive comment at this hour of the night, within just a few minutes, on an address that lasted an hour and 15 minutes, is almost an insuperable job.
Let me ask.
As a general comment, I think the address could have been shorter. After all, there is such a thing as indigestion when you pack a little too much, even into a State of the Union message.
What?
And if I had delivered it, it would have been infinitely shorter and contained a lot less. The strokes would have been broader, I think, and I would have waited for these supplemental messages that will come along from week to week in order to fill in the gaps.
Finally, Senator, what chances do you think that this legislative program will have on Capitol Hill this year?
Well, insofar as they want to implement some of these programs, all of them are going to get a good hard look. Now, you probably noticed that there is a tax provision in this message.
Will that pass?
A 6% surcharge on both corporate and individual taxes. Well, I think I can say what I said to the president when we were at the ranch discussing taxes and budget, that first we wanted to see what we could take out of the budget. Then you ascertain what the size of your deficit is going to be, and then you determine whether it's a manageable deficit that is not too depressing on the economy and you can get along without a tax increase, or whether you have to have a tax increase. I rather fancy that the figures he used in estimating the deficit for the instant fiscal year and fiscal 1968 were a little lower than I thought they would be. I expected them to be somewhat larger. But only time will tell when we get through with our work on the appropriation bills.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Yes,
sir. Senator Everett Dirksen. Again, the big surprise in the President's State of the Union address was his call for an increase in taxes. And as has been explained, it isn't so much a 6% increase in taxes as it is a tax on tax. If you've been paying about $100, you would pay about $106 in the future. As far as the war in Vietnam is concerned, the president pledged the country to stand firm and continue with essentially the approach to that problem that it has followed in the past. As for his Great Society programs, he did not pull back, but he did offer no new bold concepts in that field. I'd like to thank Edwin Newman and Douglas Kiker, as well as Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, NBC News correspondents, Dr. Song A, who's been with us here in New York, Professor John Kenneth Galbraith and his associates in London for joining us in this discussion tonight. This is Frank McGee, NBC News.